predict precisely, but we are moving towards irreversible tipping points. Every year we wait, every month we wait, the problem gets harder to deal with. Democrats don't have a great record, but at least you're talking in a political universe in which discourse, discussion, and pressure are possible. The Republican Party, I think, for the moment at least, is almost a lost cause.
That's Noam Chomsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Noam Chomsky on tipping points, environmental and political. Tipping points are in the air, and with good reason. A planetary emergency looms in the not-too-distant future. This isn't alarmist talk, but the best judgment of our leading scientists. The prestigious International Union for Conservation of Nature has just issued its starkest warning to date. Humanity, it says, has reached a tipping point. Our window of opportunity to respond is narrowing quickly. Imagine if we had paid attention to Lyndon Johnson's Science Advisory Committee in 1965, when it noted in their report entitled Restoring the Quality of Our Environment, that pollutants have altered on a global scale the carbon dioxide content of the air and the lead concentrations in ocean waters and human populations. That was 56 years ago. Today, Noam Chomsky warns, the world is hurtling toward disaster. And we have a segment of the political class that is in denial. Our guest today is Noam Chomsky, the legendary scholar activist. He's been a leading voice for peace and social justice for many decades. Noted independent journalist John Pilger says, Noam Chomsky is an enduring inspiration all over the world for the simple reason that he is a truth-teller on an epic scale. At 92, he continues to write and speak on public issues. Author of scores of books, his latest are Consequences of Capitalism and Climate Crisis and the Global Green New Deal. I talked with him on September 30th. He was at his home in Arizona. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be with you as always.
Well, in the U.S., COVID-19 has resulted in more than 700,000 dead, exceeding the 1918 pandemic figure. Globally, the death toll is in the millions. We'll probably never know the exact number. There's the Delta variant now, and we're all wondering, will there be other variants? Vaccines have been effective, yet there's a significant resistance to get vaccinated, particularly in the U.S. Why? There are bizarre notions of freedom and individual rights. No one is going to tell me what to do. But if there aren't universal vaccinations, we won't get past this epidemic. Africa, for example, only 2% of the continent's population has been fully vaccinated. What makes some people susceptible to conspiracy theories about getting vaccinated?
Well, first of all, we should look at exactly what's happening. If you look at global maps, like the kind that the New York Times posts every day, the United States stands out. It's the main global hotspot outside of Mongolia, a couple of others. If you look closely, it's not the United States. It's selected parts of the United States. Overwhelmingly, it's the old Confederacy and a couple of outliers like Idaho and Wyoming, which are rock-ribbed Republican states. There's even been analysis by counties by now, and it turns out that there's a quite sharp difference between counties that voted for Biden and counties that voted for Trump. So to a very substantial extent, it's a partisan issue. Now, parts of the left have bought into this too. They're not, I don't think, statistically significant as compared with the mass refusal on the part of Republicans. And in fact, the last poll I saw showed that over 50%, I think it was 55% of Republicans said they were not going to get vaccinated. So it's not just the country's refusing. It's bad enough among others too, especially sectors of the left that have been caught up in this. But very substantially, it's a Republican issue. It's very serious. Not just, it's killing hundreds of thousands of people. That's bad enough. It's also endangering many others. The hospitals in the red areas, the Republican areas, like Idaho, Alabama, are being crushed by COVID cases. Idaho recently announced, or maybe it was Wyoming, announced recently that they're going to have to stop providing regular services in hospitals because they have no place. Actually, in a minor way, that happened to me too. Couldn't get to a hospital that I needed to because they had no beds. It wasn't terrible. I survived. And apart from the social cost, which is huge, just expense, lack of care, and so on, they're endangering people. The hospitals are close to 100% unvaccinated. The unvaccinated are endangering others. They're severely endangering children who can't get vaccinated yet. They have no protection. They're even endangering the vaccinated. I mean, the vaccine is very effective, but not 100%. So yes, they're endangering the vaccinated too. And on top of that, they're creating a pool in which the virus can mutate freely, maybe lead to a variant that might not even be treatable. It could be a raging, untreatable pandemic. Why is this done? Liberty? There's no such liberty. There's no liberty that allows you to drive through a red light because you feel like it and you don't want to be inhibited. Nobody's ever claimed such a liberty. It's outlandish. You want to hurt people? Okay, go find a plot of land somewhere, sit on it, and don't take any benefits from the government and don't take any responsibilities. There's no liberty involved. The whole libertarian nonsense thing is pure nonsense. Furthermore, we've had vaccine mandates, strict ones, much stricter than now, for years. You can't send your kid to school without a vaccine, rightly. Why should you be able to endanger other children? That's been in place for a long time. There's no real mandates now. What's called mandates have an alternative. You can agree to get tested every week or two. This is, I think, the sign of, it's a symptom of severe social disorder, social collapse, party, a former political party, which has simply gone rogue. Not just my opinion. Day or two ago, the Financial Times, the major business newspaper in the world, sober, conservative, their leading correspondent, Martin Wolf, highly respected conservative analyst, wrote a column in which he said, it's just indescribable. He said, the Republican Party has become a group of crazed radicals dedicated to reactionary policies. We see it not only on this, we see it on what's going on right now in Washington. The Republicans have been holding the country hostage by refusing to agree to the normal procedure, perfectly normal procedure, of raising the debt ceiling to account for things that have already been done. When Trump was in office, he made a huge increase in the deficit with his lavish gifts to the rich. The Democrats went along, raised the debt ceiling every time it was necessary. Republicans won't do it. In fact, they finally, just now, the last news I looked at, sort of agreed, as long as conditions were imposed, to block any form of mandate for small and medium-sized businesses. In other words, you want to harm the employees in a restaurant, feel free to do it. It's your right to harm them, okay? That's the Republican Party. They also tried to cut off funding for Afghan refugees. I mean, it's just a gang of sadists, the political leadership. And the shamelessness is indescribable. Now take the hearing for Milley.
General Milley, the chief of staff.
I mean, he went through denunciations by a series of Republicans, Josh Hawley, a bunch of other frauds, condemning him for the withdrawal from Afghanistan. Take a look at the record. Until about a month ago, the Republican Party national website hailed the great genius Trump for arranging a much worse withdrawal. In February 2020, Trump simply gave away the store. He, of course, didn't inform the Afghan government, obviously not the Afghan people. Why should he care about them? Made an arrangement with the Taliban for US forces to withdraw in May 2021, worst possible time, beginning of the fighting season. Essentially no conditions. Do whatever you like. The only condition is don't fire at American troops. Won't look good for me. Biden came along, somewhat improved the awful Trump arrangement. He put it off a little, a couple months, a little bit of minimal time to accommodate, added a few conditions that Trump hadn't put in place. The Republican Party 100% was lauding Trump for his historic achievement until the moment when it began to collapse. Then they switched on a dime. All of them are berating Milley and others for carrying out an improved version of the policy that they had been lauding as a historic achievement when the hero that they worship was proposing it. The word shameless doesn't cover this. There's no words. It's a party that has totally gone rogue on issue after issue. Now, it's not just this. That's why the Republicans are denying global warming, the population, large parts. If you tune to Fox News, Breitbart, you're listening to the leadership of the Republican Party, that's all you hear. Okay, maybe the virus is a bioweapon created by the Chinese to attack Americans. That's about 35% of Republicans. Maybe Bill Gates is trying to put a chip in your head so he can control you. Maybe the government is run by an elite of sadistic pedophiles who are trying to torture children, 25% of Republicans. I mean, yes, if you're stuck in that bubble and that's what you're hearing from a political leadership that has lost even minimal commitment to the functioning of democracy, well, these are the results you get. And it's very straight. There's nothing hidden. McConnell came straight out and said again, as he did when Obama was elected, our responsibility is to make the country ungovernable, to make sure that nothing can be done that would benefit the American people. Sensible strategy, if the population is harmed sufficiently, we can then come along, blame it on the Democrats. Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, you'll echo it. And then maybe we can come back to power. Okay? If you've lost any commitment to the country and to its people and to, of course, some form of democracy, and you're solely committed to your own power and to the economic powers that you serve slavishly, concentrated wealth, ultra wealth, corporate power, if that's who you are, then this is a sensible way to behave. Of course, it'll ruin the country, but who cares?
I can hear critics of you saying, sounds like Chomsky's becoming an advocate for the Democratic Party. That's not the case.
Not in the least. Their party, their policies are terrible. And most of what I write is criticism of the Democratic Party. I answered this question because you asked it. So yes, if I'm asked what's going on, that's what's going on. Take a look at the Democrats, what I've actually been writing and speaking. So let's start with August 9th. The IPCC came out with its latest report. Very dire report, said far more clearly than before, we're at a critical moment. We have to start reducing fossil fuels steadily right now, continuing until we're free of them by essentially mid-century. That's August 9th. What happened on August 10th? Joe Biden issued an appeal to OPEC, the oil cartel, to increase oil production so as to reduce gas prices in the United States, which will help his electoral prospects. Okay? Is that the party we're supposed to be lauding? I can go on easily. I mean, there's plenty to condemn about the Democrats, but they're a political party which does plenty of wrong things. They're not a rogue insurgency which is committed to serving a narrow constituency of extreme wealth and doesn't give a damn how much they harm the country and the world. That's not a political party anymore. It's off the spectrum. It's, as Martin Wolf pointed out, you can rank them among the ultra-right parties in Europe with neo-fascist origins.
The IPCC report, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, it was 3,000 pages, the work of over 200 scientists. It warned what dangers the planet is facing, and the report concluded average global temperatures will likely rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit by the year 2040. And UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called the report, I'm quoting, a code red for humanity. He said, if we combine forces now, we can avert climate catastrophe. But as the IPCC report makes clear, there's no time for delay and no room for excuses. The month of July was the hottest on record. The World Meteorological Organization, the UN Weather Agency, on September 1st, says only immediate large-scale reductions in greenhouse gas emissions can avert a global disaster. So the evidence is piling up. There's mountains of it, which should be challenging the skeptics. Nevertheless, you know, take our great neighbor to the north, Canada. Just the other day, Enbridge, which is a major Canadian corporation, it's extending a pipeline from the tar sands in Alberta to Wisconsin, tar sands being the dirtiest oil on the planet. And this is happening despite years of opposition from environmentalists and indigenous groups.
Well, take a look at the business press, especially the petroleum journals. The major oil companies are absolutely euphoric are beside themselves. They're finding new areas to explore. The current budget for the United States government continues even to provide subsidies to fossil fuel companies. Republicans wouldn't tolerate anything else. Canada's bad enough, and other countries aren't doing that wonderfully. But the United States is indescribable. A former political organization, now calling itself the Republican Party, is dedicated to maximizing, accelerating the race to catastrophe. Take a look at the Republican states, Republican legislators, they're not going to hide it. Got a race to catastrophe to enrich the energy corporations as much as possible before we reach apocalypse. Okay? That's one part of the fading American democracy. Take a look at the one party that's still functioning, the Democratic Party. Split. There's a major split within it, which offers the opportunity, at least, to push forward on the programs that are known, well-known, feasible, can not only mitigate the crisis, but lead to a much better world. They're on the table. There's a resolution by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ed Markey, senior senator from Massachusetts. It gives a detailed outline of quite feasible proposals, well within cost range, that could in fact solve the crisis, lead the way to a much better society. It's a resolution. Okay, that's a step forward. It reached that far because of extensive popular activism, mostly among young people, Sunrise Movement, others, finally got to that point. There's the resolution, if you look at it, the details are approximately the same as what was produced by the International Energy Association, originally a producer-based group, which has recognized that we have to do something about this and has come out with detailed proposals, very much like that, very similar to the quite detailed, extensive proposals of my co-author, Robert Pollan, leading economist who's worked hard on this, Jeff Sachs, another important economist who's somewhat different model comes out with pretty much the same conclusions. It's all within range, can be done, it's on paper. Can you get it through? Well, Democratic Party, the Republicans are going to kill it. That's given. They don't care what happens to the planet. They don't give a damn. They have other commitments, their own power, and the super rich. In fact, you look at the commitment, it is unbelievable. Take a look at the so-called negotiations that have been going on in Congress. Republicans established an absolute red line. No increase in taxes for the super rich and the corporate sector. You cannot touch Trump's one legislative achievement, a tax scam, which stabbed the country in the back, including the working classes and the middle classes, in order to enrich the very rich. That's a red line. Furthermore, another part of the red line is you can't fund the IRS to enable it to catch tax cheaters. Rich people and corporations with huge numbers of corporate lawyers who figure out how to rob the population of trillions of dollars. You can't fund the IRS to investigate them. That's the former Republican Party. We're looking at a group of radical sadists. Okay, let's say it straight out. That's what it is. Okay, turn to the Democrats. They're split. The Clintonite, Obama type, neoliberal, Wall Street oriented Democrats who pretty much run the party apparatus. They're reluctant. They're not going to push. And some of the right-wing Democrats, mislabeled moderate, like mansion and cinema, looks like a total cynic, flush with corporate money, are holding back on even minimal things. A cinema, for example, won't even say what she would agree to in the reconciliation bill. Just, she won't agree. What would you agree to? Sorry, can't say, you know. The Democratic Party split between these groups on the one hand and progressive, mostly young people who are pressuring them to try to save us from destruction on the climate, on the pandemic, on the breakdown of the society. The reconciliation bill, so-called, moves to give the population some respite from the neoliberal assault of the last 40 years, to give some improvement, spawned to the major attack on the general population. There's nothing radical in it. There was an article recently in the New York Times by a bright conservative Harvard economist, Greg Mankiw, saying, well, yes, we don't have good social policies, but we make up for it by having a higher GDP per capita. He failed to add one small point. American workers work many more hours than workers in Europe. In Germany, workers get 2 months guaranteed vacation. Most of Europe, something similar. Yeah, if people work 20% more, you're going to have higher GDP. Big insight. Okay? That's the kind of thing we're living with. You can't talk about the simplest things. We're living with a collapse of the social order, major assault for the last 40 years. It's some attempt to recover, to move back towards the kind of country that, say, Dwight Eisenhower would have welcomed. It's considered too radical to push forward. The Democratic right wing won't accept it. Well, where do we go from there?
Well, someone who's not mincing words, interestingly enough, is the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres. He says, we continue to destroy the things on which we depend for life on Earth. Ice caps and glaciers continue to melt. Sea level rise is accelerating, the ocean is dying, and biodiversity is collapsing. We really are, he says, out of time. We must act now to prevent further irreversible damage. We keep hearing these calls, which invariably include the words tipping point. How many tipping points is it going to take before we tip over and into the abyss?
Well, can't predict precisely, but we are moving towards irreversible tipping points. Every year we wait, every month we wait, the problem gets harder to deal with. If we had dealt with it 10 years ago, it would be much less dire today, much easier ways to deal with it. If we had dealt with it 30 years ago, when it was perfectly clear where we were heading, been far easier. You recall that the first Bush administration refused even to join the Kyoto Protocol. We have to keep to the high priorities, enrich the very rich, maintain massive profits for the corporate sector. What happens to the country and the world is secondary. Democrats don't have a great record. They pretty much went along. But at least within the Democratic Party, you're talking in a political universe in which discourse, discussion, and pressure are possible. That's how the country's divided now. Well, we don't know exactly when the tipping points will come, but they'll come. In fact, some of them may have come already. It's possible. We may have reached them already. If not, we'll reach them pretty soon. You get to an irreversible tipping point, series of them. It doesn't mean that everybody dies tomorrow. Country will survive, other countries will survive, but we're on a course towards total apocalypse.
You're listening to Noam Chomsky, Tipping Points, Environmental and Political. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can get CDs of this program and Chomsky's latest books, Consequences of Capitalism and Climate Crisis and the Global Green New Deal, by calling us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go to our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Meanwhile, incidentally, destroying other species at an incredible rate, which hasn't been seen for 65 million years. All of this is known. We don't have to rehearse it. It's very well established. There's really no debate about it, at least among rational people. There are, more importantly, clear measures to deal with it. And in fact, some positive steps. So take, say, West Virginia, where their own senator is working very hard to harm the people of West Virginia as much as he can in service to his corporate masters, that's Manchin. But the population of West Virginia is beginning to see the light. It's coal state. United Mine Workers recently agreed to a transition program in which there would be transition from a coal-based economy for West Virginia, which has to disappear, otherwise we won't be around, to transition from that to a renewable energy economy. They have the capacity to do it. The transition proposal took into account the needs of the working people who will be affected by a short-run loss of jobs, new kinds of jobs, training, better jobs, for all part of the transition plan. I should say that Bob Pollan has been quite active in working with labor unions in West Virginia, Ohio, California. Many of them are moving in this direction. There are possible forces which can work on it, and activists can do something. They must, in fact. The only hope, the Republican Party, I think, for the moment at least, is almost a lost cause. I say almost, because if you look closely, younger Republicans are not as insane and despicable as the leadership. They are more open to concern about these issues. That's hope too. They're not Susan Collins and Josh Hawley, so you can have some hope there, and that should be pressed. And among the general population, including Republicans, I think they're reachable. They're stuck in a Fox News Republican leadership bubble, but that doesn't mean they can't be moved. Take effort, work, but they're human beings. They care about them, their children. They care about the environment, and they can be reached. So it's not a lost cause, but it's going to take serious, committed work with sympathy, understanding, dedication. We don't have to cover up what's going on among the major criminals, the leadership of the former Republican Party, for example, or plenty in the Democratic Party. Don't cover that up, but there are possibilities to move forward.
Edward Said, in the 25th anniversary preface of his classic book, Orientalism, wrote, "Every single empire in its official discourse has said that it's not like all the others, that its circumstances are special, that it has a mission to enlighten, civilize, bring order and democracy, and that it uses force only as a last resort. And sadder still, there's always a chorus of willing intellectuals to say calming words about benign or altruistic empires, as if one shouldn't trust the evidence of one's eyes, watching the destruction and the misery and death brought by the latest civilizing mission. Did the U.S. in Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere replicate what Saeed wrote about?
He's certainly right. Absolutely right. You don't have to tell me about it. I've been trumpeting that for 50 years. It's exactly correct. What's called American exceptionalism is mistaken in two respects. For one thing, the claims about what makes us exceptional are easily disproven. For another, there's nothing exceptional about it. It was the same with every other major power. Well, France was officially committed to exterminating the Algerians, was the slogan of the major general. Exterminating the Algerians. Intellectuals in France were praising the civilizing mission of France. Well, Britain was carrying out some of its worst atrocities in India. John Stuart Mill, a really respectable intellectual, if anybody was, right at the highest peak, was writing about, and he knew all about it. He was officially the East India Company, knew everything that was going on. While this was going on, huge massacres to repress an Indian uprising, moves to invade and conquer more of India so that Britain could extend its monopoly of the opium trade, the biggest narco-trafficking racket in history, source of a lot of British wealth, in order to break into China by force and destroy China. While that was going on, John Stuart Mill wrote an essay on intervention, which is read in law schools and is read as if it was an opposition to intervention. But when you read it, it turns out what he was saying is, Britain is such an angelic power that others can't understand us. They heap obloquy upon us. They think we're working for crass ends because we are so much above the human race that they cannot perceive our dedication to the highest goals. And that includes bringing civilization to India, to barbaric India. It's our responsibility to do it by smashing them in the face, murdering them, conquering them, to extend our opium monopoly so we can break into China. He didn't add that part, I added it. But that's what he knew was happening. Well, that's John Stuart Mill, not a right winger, the peak of human enlightenment, okay? We can go on. If we had records from Attila the Hun, we'd probably find the same thing. You try hard to find an exception in human history. I can't find one. Yeah, that's right. And the role of the intellectuals is to praise it, to say how wonderful we are. Maybe we make mistakes. After all, anybody can make mistakes. But we're basically dedicated to the highest good. I mean, I hate to repeat it, but I've been writing about this for 50 years. So take the end, one example, which is striking. End of the Vietnam War, 1975. Everybody, big name, had to write an article about it, of course. I reviewed them. They're quite interesting. They range from the hawks to the doves. The hawks say, stabbed in the back, peace movement killed us. If we'd been able to fight harder, we could have won. You know, that line, that's on the right. It's not interesting. What's interesting is the so-called left. Way to the extreme left, you get people like Anthony Lewis, about as strong an anti-war voice as you could find anywhere in the mainstream. He wrote an interesting article in which he said, New York Times, he said, the war began with blundering efforts to do good. Evidence that it was efforts to do good? No, that's an axiom. It's an axiom that it was efforts to do good because we did it, okay? Blundering, well, didn't work. So it started with blundering efforts to do good by definition. But by 1969, it was clear that it was a disaster. We couldn't bring democracy to the people of South Vietnam at a cost that was acceptable to ourselves. Okay, that's the extreme criticism on the left. Were we trying to bring democracy? Well, you don't have to argue that. That's true by definition again. Was it efforts to do good by definition because we're so magnificent? Is the only issue whether is that the cost was too high? Well, you could think of some other issues. Could it possibly have been the worst crime of aggression since the Second World War, of the kind for which German war criminals were hanged at Nuremberg? Well, couldn't have been that, even though it was. So there's no American exceptionalism. It's a repeat of other great powers and their violence and terror. We have, and it's no exceptionalism in that there were wonderful deeds. I mean, after all, people talk about endless wars. The endless wars for the United States began in 1783 and have not stopped since, as a number of people are finally commenting, even former President Carter. Soon as the British yoke was lifted, the colonists were able to set forth on their mission. One of the leading diplomatic histories of the United States by Thomas Bailey says the colonists were free to set forth on their mission of felling trees and Indians and extending to the natural borders. Pretty honest. We had to turn to felling trees and Indians and extending to the national borders. That means invading and attacking the Indian nations, exterminating them, smashing them to pieces, breaking treaties, genocidal attacks right to the end of the century. Meanwhile, picking up half of Mexico in what General President Grant called one of the most wicked wars in history, accurately, war of aggression, where I'm living right now, Arizona, California, stealing Hawaii from its inhabitants by force and guile, moving on to invade the Philippines, killing a couple hundred thousand people, then on and through intervention, violence, terror, aggression all over. That's American exceptionalism. And it's not exceptional.
You mentioned the word exterminate. It reminded me of in the book that you did a decade ago called Gaza in Crisis with the Israeli historian Ilan Pape. You have an essay in that book entitled Exterminate All the Brutes, which is the exact words of the deranged Kurtz character in Joseph Conrad's famous novel, Heart of Darkness.
Actually, I was borrowing it from a more appropriate source, John Quincy Adams, the Secretary of State and President, the intellectual father of Manifest Destiny, responsible for some of the main atrocities, Seminole War in Florida, others. In his later years, when he was reflecting on what happened, he lamented, I'm quoting him now, he lamented the fate of that hapless race of Native Americans, which we have exterminated with such merciless and perfidious cruelty. That was before the worst of the atrocities, which were in California later. Well, okay. That's the father of Manifest Destiny. He was right. He was not the first to use it. The Secretary of War under Washington, Henry Knox, said something pretty similar. Said we're exterminating, this is right at the beginning of the process, we're exterminating the natives in ways that are worse than those of the conquistadors in South America. Horrible atrocities. They knew what they were doing. George Washington said the Indians, he said, are like wolves. savages in human form, beasts in human form. They have to be driven into the wilderness like the leaves. That's George Washington. He's known by the Iroquois as the town destroyer, was known, because even before the Revolutionary War was over, he launched a major campaign of destruction among the Iroquois nations. There were exceptions, of course, here and there, there always are, but that's the overwhelming center, that's the mainstream. You always have wild men in the wings, who are usually treated pretty badly. Differs depending on the nature of the society, but goes all through history, right back to classical Greece. The guy who had to commit suicide by taking the hemlock was the man who was guilty of corrupting the youth of Athens by asking too many questions. We don't want that kind of wild man in the wings around, okay? Pretty much standard throughout history. The kind of treatment they get depends on the society and who they are. So in the United States, if you're a privileged person like Edward Said or me, punishment's not too bad. Maybe vilification, denunciation, things. Said had to have police protection, had to have a buzzer in his apartment so he could call the police in case he was attacked, that kind of thing. If you're Fred Hampton, black organizer, you can be assassinated by the National Political Police. Depends who you are.
Hampton was murdered in 1969 in Chicago. Conrad was writing about what the Belgians were doing in the Congo. That was the backdrop to Heart of Darkness. But let's now move on to Afghanistan and what happened there and the comparisons that the armchair pundits have been making to Saigon in 1975. Tariq Ali, who's not one of those armchair pundits, in an interview I did with him in early September, called what happened in Afghanistan, I'm quoting, a huge blow to the American empire, and that no amount of spin can cover up the debacle. Is it a bit early to be writing the obituary of the American empire?
I think it's, as far as the American empire is concerned, it's a blip, literally a blip. I mean, from the point of view of the American empire, the invasion of Afghanistan was a mistake. George Bush, this is W. Bush, the second one, he and his surrounding courtiers, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, decided to invade Afghanistan without any strategic objective. They were doing it. I think the best description of what they were doing was given by the most respected figure of the anti-Taliban resistance in Afghanistan, Abdul Haq, highly respected, revered leader. In October 2001, he had a important interview with Anatole Yevin, who's a specialist on Central Asia. And Yevin asked him, why do you think the Americans are invading? He said, they're invading. They know they're going to kill plenty of Afghans. They're going to undermine our efforts to overthrow the Taliban from within, which he outlined, which were feasible. But they don't care. They want to show their muscle and intimidate everyone. So they're invading. That's pretty much what Donald Rumsfeld was saying. Taliban offered to surrender totally, which of course meant giving up any remnants of Al-Qaeda that were there. Rumsfeld's answer was, we do not negotiate surrenders. We want to smash you to pieces. He didn't say this, I'm adding what was in his head. We want to smash you to pieces, to show our muscle, intimidate everyone, then go on to our real targets. We don't care about Afghanistan. we want to go on to Iraq, major target, then on to the rest of the Middle East. All of that actually was publicized. I'm not making that up. He didn't say it in those words. So they invaded Afghanistan. They didn't know that Al-Qaeda was responsible for 9/11. In fact, 8 months after 9/11, the head of the FBI, Robert Mueller, gave his first major press conference, in which he was asked, of course, what have you found out about 9/11? And he said, well, this is after the greatest investigation, deepest investigation in history, probably, international investigation. He said, we assume that it was probably Al-Qaeda, but we haven't been able to prove it, okay? That's 8 months after the US invaded to show its muscle and intimidate everyone. Of course, that's not the story you read, but it's the fact. You can read it in the press right at the time. If they wanted to capture Al-Qaeda, bin Laden, and others, a small police operation would have sufficed, probably with the cooperation of the Taliban, who at that point were quite eager to get rid of this burden. But nothing. We do not negotiate surrender. W. Bush, the decider, was asked later, what do you think about Al-Qaeda? He said, we don't really care. We're not interested in them. We don't know where they are. We're interested in bigger game. By then, they were on to Iraq, a real prize. We can smash up and destroy Iraq, get control of its oil. That's something real. Then we can use that as a springboard to go on. So who cares about Afghanistan? So pulling out of Afghanistan is, in fact, withdrawing from a mistake for once. Didn't have the kind of strategic objectives that the Vietnam War did. Afghanistan, nothing was achieved. It was a mistake. Of course, it's a disaster for Afghans, but it's not our business. Now the question is, can we do something for compensation? Can we help them in some way? Well, what we ought to be doing is joining with the regional powers, China, Central Asian governments, Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, Russia, joining with them to try to offer whatever assistance we can to the Afghans so they can somehow overcome the crisis of actually 40 years of war. They're desperate. They're starving. They don't have food. Okay, we can help with that. What we're actually doing is holding on to their funds, which happen to be in the New York banks, holding on to them, not giving them back, pressuring the IMF and the World Bank not to give loans. We actually are joining with India, your favorite country, to undermine the efforts of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization to take steps to assist the Afghans. India, in the meeting a couple of days ago, joined with the United States is not a member. They don't accept the United States. But joining with its U.S. master to undercut the efforts of the regional powers to do something to reduce the terror and violence that the Afghans are suffering by offering them some aid, trying to work with them, trying to integrate them into the region somehow. India and the United States are blocking it. Well, it doesn't have to happen. Okay? So that's what we can do now, as well as, of course, providing ample assistance to the Afghan refugees. That's our first responsibility. Unfortunately, we have a sadistic organization which controls half the government, which just today tried to cut aid to Afghans from the agreement to raise the debt ceiling, tried to cut it. Well, fortunately, that didn't work. That's the country we're in.
With an article you recently had in The Economist and a New York Times crossword puzzle in which your name is a clue, is there a danger you're going mainstream?
I wouldn't worry about it.
Thanks very much, Noam.
Great.
Great to talk to you again.
You were just listening to Noam Chomsky on Tipping Points, Environmental and Political. I talked with him on September 30th. Noam Chomsky, the legendary scholar activist, is America's leading dissident intellectual. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and progressive and in our 36th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. Since its inception, we've made a special effort to record and archive Professor Chomsky's work. We have more than 260 recordings. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. If you'd like a free copy of a printed transcript, PDF, or MP3 of this program, just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.